This is April 27th, 2014, and I'll be reading from teachings of a great Japanese Zen master, Dogen. And this is from a book with a title, A Primer of Soto Zen. The subtitle is A Translation of Dogen's Shobogenzo Zuimonki. Last night, yesterday, I was in my usual foraging for teisho material mode and went through a lot of different possibilities, but I found myself pulled back again and again to the topic of impermanence and death. My eyes fell on this great jewel of teaching, and I have some selections here. We're told on the back cover here that the Shobogenzo Zuimonki consists largely of brief talks, hortatory remarks, and instructional and cautionary comments by the Soto Zen master Dogen. His dates, by the way, are 1200 to 1253. Shobogenzo, the first word of those of the title, Shobogenzo means the eye of the true law. The second word, Zuimonki, roughly translated means easy for the ears to understand or simplified. So especially accessible text of Dogen's teachings. Dogen is so profound. Many of his things can be pretty inaccessible for most people, but this is quite down to earth. And by the way, is one of the this is one of the oldest Zen texts translated into English. It was one of the very few texts that Roshi Kaplow had to use for his commentaries in Teisho back in the 60s and 70s. There's so many more Zen books now have been translated into English, that is, books of original teachings of the masters. But this is one of the early ones, earliest ones. I'm going to skip to about a third of the way into the book. One day a student asked, "I have spent months and years in earnest practice, but I have yet to gain enlightenment. Many of the old masters say that the way does not depend on intelligence and cleverness, and that there is no need for knowledge and talent. As I understand it, even though my capacity is inferior, I need not feel badly of myself. Are there any old sayings or cautionary words that I should know about?" This his reference to the fact that his capacity is inferior, this idea of ranking people by their native capacity is one that you see also in Chinese Zen texts, those of inferior capacity, those of medium capacity, those of superior capacity. I don't find it very helpful to even read about that, those kind of categorizations. Maybe because Americans, maybe more than Japanese or Chinese, have this tendency to be hard on themselves. I've often said that Asian teachers, more than a couple, I've heard, feel this is one of the most stubborn afflictions of Americans in particular is this inner critical voice. And almost inevitably, when you mention these kinds of three levels of ability or capacity, people will start figuring out what is there, where do they place themselves. The real point is that we all are equally endowed with this luminous, bright mind of enlightenment. And yes, we have different amounts of baggage that we bring into this life, and that we then build up more through our youth and into adulthood. We have different dispositions or tendencies. Some people tend to cling more to thoughts and mental attachments than others, but it's the last thing you want to do is focus on yourself and where you belong in this categorization. But maybe this wasn't such a big deal for this questioner, the monk who's asking this question. He says, although my capacity is inferior. Another possibility is that, like so many Japanese, this is just a kind of a matter of etiquette, where he introduces himself more or less in this self-effacing way. This is pretty foreign to Americans also. So he's just asking, can you help me out here? I'm not sure that I got much to bring to this practice other than some intelligence and cleverness. So Dogen replied, yes, there are some old sayings. True practice of the way does not rely on knowledge and genius or cleverness and brilliance. But it is a mistake to encourage people to be like blind men, deaf mutes, or imbeciles. Because practice has no use for wide learning and high intelligence, even those with inferior capacities can participate. True practice of the way is an easy thing. So he's taking both sides here. He says it doesn't really matter what your IQ is. On the other hand, he's saying we don't need to reject our intellectual abilities. We don't need to. Zen is not anti-intellectual. But then he goes on, but even in the monasteries of China, only one or two out of several hundred or even 1,000 disciples under a great Zen master actually gained true enlightenment. He's really surely here referring to deep satori, deep self-realization, not an initial experience of awakening to the true nature. He's not referring to entering the first gate, which is another phrase for passing one's first koan. Therefore, old sayings and cautionary words are needed. As I see it now, it is a matter of gaining the desire to practice. A person who gives rise to a real desire and puts his utmost efforts into practice under a teacher will surely gain enlightenment. Essentially, one must devote all attention to this effort and enter into practice with all due speed. More specifically, the following points must be kept in mind. In the first place, there must be a keen and sincere desire to seek the way. For example, someone who wishes to steal a precious jewel, to attack a formidable enemy, or to make the acquaintance of a beautiful woman must at all times watch intently for the opportunity, adjusting to changing events and shifting circumstances. Anything sought for with such intensity will surely be gained. If the desire to search for the way becomes as intense as this, whether you concentrate on doing zazen alone, investigate a koan by an old master, go to Doksan, or practice with sincere devotion, you will succeed no matter how high you must shoot or no matter how deep you must plumb. Without arousing this wholehearted will for the Buddha way, how can anyone succeed in this most important task of cutting the endless round of birth and death? Those who have this drive, even if they have little knowledge or of inferior capacity, even if they are stupid or evil, will, without fail, gain enlightenment. So I know from my experience and many years of giving Doksan that there may be people now who, upon hearing this, will say, I can't really say that I have this absolute fervent longing to awaken. But don't despair, because we have the capacity to develop that, and it starts with doing zazen. Is the sitting is how we cultivate and foster this innate need for awakening to our true nature. So everything really starts with the sitting. The more sitting we do, the more we're going to uncover this most fundamental of all human needs, which is the need to understand who and what we are, the nature of reality, our own nature. That's all there. No one lacks that. There's no inferior or superior to that. We all have it in equal measure. The rest is just a matter of bringing it forth, allowing it to emerge, to come up to consciousness, to motivate our efforts. And that will happen if we can maintain a daily practice, not 5 or 10 minutes a day. That's not going to do much. But if you can, the more sitting you do every day or every week, the more you're going to create the ground in which that seed, that Buddha seed, as we say in the first of the three refuges, the three treasures, that Buddha seed can germinate and really carry us forth. So besides sitting, he says, next, to arouse such a mind, one must be deeply aware of the impermanence of the world. This realization is not achieved by some temporary method of contemplation. It is not creating something out of nothing and then thinking about it. In other words, he's saying we don't need to contrive some awareness of impermanence, of the ephemeral nature of life. It's right before us all the time. He goes on, impermanence is a fact before our eyes. Do not wait for the teachings from others, the words of the sutras, and for the principles of enlightenment. We are born in the morning and die in the evening. The person we saw yesterday is no longer with us today. These are facts we see with our own eyes and hear with our own ears. You see and hear impermanence in terms of another person, but try weighing it with your own body. Even though you live to be 70 or 80, that would have been a long life in the 13th century when Dogen lived. He himself only lived to be 53. Even though you live to be 70 or 80, you die in accordance with the inevitability of death. How will you ever come to terms with the worries, joys, intimacies, and conflicts that concern you in this life? With faith in the Dharma, seek the true happiness of nirvana. How can those who are old or who have passed the halfway mark in their lives, especially, relax in their practice when there is no way of telling how many years are left? Just to go back to the middle of this passage, referring to seeing or hearing about people dying who are near us or in our village or town. He says, these are facts we see with our own eyes and hear with our own ears. Well, to be fair, less so in our contemporary society. We have found ways of shielding ourselves or distancing ourselves from death and dying, starting with distance. We're so much more dispersed. Families are so much dispersed than in ancient times. And we are able, if you're determined enough, we're able to deny the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death to a much greater extent than in old times. By and large, people when they're dying are whisked away and family, they're nearby, they visit them and all, but surely in Dogen's time, people were much more in touch with the dying process and deaths than we are today. How can those who are old or who have passed the halfway mark in their lives relax in their practice when there is no way of telling how many years are left? Then he goes on, even this is putting it too simply. Think of what might happen today, this very moment, in the ordinary world and the Buddhist world as well. Perhaps tonight, perhaps tomorrow, you will fall seriously ill, find your body racked with unendurable pain, die suddenly by an unforeseen cause, meet misfortune at the hands of robbers, or be slain by someone seeking vengeance. Life is indeed an uncertain thing. In this hateful world where death may come at any time, it is absurd to plan your life, intrigue maliciously against others, and spend your time in fruitless pursuits. I think it's very important to broaden our understanding of death here. It's not just what happens to us after 80 or 90 years if we're lucky, but what is happening all the time. First of all, in the terms of the losses that we suffer now and then, just losing someone close to us, but besides that, losing a job is a kind of death. Identity theft is I've never suffered that, but I can imagine that it's a kind of a modern loss that could be compared to death. Um, cancellation of health insurance that might lead to bankruptcy is a kind of death. These each one of these losses will reveal to us our preparedness for death. That is, what that really means is the extent to which we can just exhale and let go and go with the loss, or the extent to which, on the other hand, we cling, we try to hold on and fight what has happened. And then, besides these occasional death-like losses that we can experience, it's just the fact of what sometimes in Buddhism called the continuous dying that is happening. This, of course, doesn't have the same painful impact as getting fired or losing a job or breaking up in a relationship or suffering a divorce. But this is happening all the time, moment by moment, micro moment by micro moment. There is no enduring self. This is what has been called continuous dying. He goes on, because impermanence is a fact of life, the Buddha spoke of it for the sake of all beings, and the patriarchs taught of this alone. Even now, in the lecture hall and in their instructions, Zen masters dwell on the swiftness of impermanence and the vital matter of birth and death. I repeat, don't forget this truth. Think only of this very moment, and waste no time in turning your minds to the practice of the way. After this, it is easy. It has nothing to do with the quality of your nature or the dullness or keenness of your capacity. Well, we can hear these words about the certainty of death, the uncertainty of the time of death, the swiftness of impermanence and the vital matter, all these things. We can hear them again and again and again and again. But let's be frank. How many people really absorb them, the truth of these things, the truth of impermanence? How many of us use it as an operating principle in our lives? If we do it less than Zen Master Dogen's contemporaries, 800 years ago or whatever, if we do it less, then it may be because of the tremendous variety of diversions we have in modern society. The electronic devices, the computers, and all the media, we can easily spend one lifetime after another of just frittering away our time idly surfing this or that media. It's really we can all agree that there's some wonderful things that come from this new digital age, but certainly we can be sure that to the extent that these things distract us from what Dogen here is talking about, these essential matters, then they are anything but blessings. In another, an evening talk, Dogen said, he starts by quoting Confucius, "In the morning, hear the way, in the evening, die content." And then Dogen says, "Students today should emulate this attitude. Over long eons, we have on innumerable occasions gone through the process of being born and dying, yet rarely have we had the chance of obtaining a human body and becoming acquainted with the Dharma. If we do not save ourselves now, in what world can we expect to do so? It is impossible to retain this body no matter how we treasure it. Since in the end we all must die, if we dedicate our bodies to the Dharma for a day or even for a moment, we lay the basis for eternal peace." This is this runs through many, 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 many Buddhist texts all through the ages, is this great opportunity we have as human beings to realize our true nature, to see through this world of illusion, this world of appearances, to what is beyond it, what is beyond phenomena, all phenomena. Not just thoughts, feelings, emotions. What is beyond all phenomena? What is that which is beyond all phenomena? This is really the work of breath practice. This is the work of koan practice. This is the work of shikantaza. Seeing beyond, seeing through. The promising thing is that everyone who undertakes this practice has already seen through to an unusual extent. Seen, there is an awareness, some maybe dim awareness, but some inkling that there is something beyond what we can apprehend through our ordinary mind. There's something more, something eternal, something transcendent that we can realize. This is a wonderful thing. To get just this far, just to get to the point where we are undertaking practice. And then if we can just persevere at it, then this mind that seeks the way, is to use Dogen's phrase, this mind that seeks the way will be nourished, strengthened, and our lives will change. He goes on, "It is a sorry thing to spend your days and nights in vain, thinking about things that might be, planning for tomorrow's livelihood, and hesitating to forsake what should be forsaken and to practice what should be practiced. At the outset, arouse the determination to hear the way and follow the Dharma for just this one day, even if you should die." This phrase, it is a mistake to hesitate to forsake what should be forsaken. Well, this perhaps doesn't need to be spelled out. Each individual can understand what that means. How do you simplify your life? What can you do? Do you need all of the things, all of the activities, all of the concerns, which are mostly self-concerns? How much of all of these complications do we need to hold on to? It's one of the marvelous things about doing extended periods of sitting, such as sesshin, retreats, meditation, seclusions, is we experience what a truly simplified life is, the rewards, how enriched our lives become when we strip everything down the way we do in Sesshin, where there's no talking, there's no reading, there's no involvement in electronic diversions and other things. And yet, people would all experience this, but then they come out of Sesshin and they just dive back into all of the clutter of the mind. One day Dogen instructed, if you talk about a person's cleverness or stupidity, it shows that you have yet to arouse the determination to practice the way. When an ordinary person falls off a horse, many things rush through his mind before he even hits the ground. In the same way, when any great threat to life and limb occurs, everybody devotes his full thought and knowledge in an effort to escape from harm. At such times, nobody, whether he be clever or stupid, thinks any differently from anybody else. Well, because you're not thinking. You're just completely without, beyond thought at such moments of emergency. Therefore, if you can spur and arouse your determination with the thought that you might die tonight or tomorrow, or that at any time you might meet with some terrible misfortune, you can expect to gain enlightenment. A dull person, if he earnestly gives rise to the determination, will gain enlightenment faster than someone who is merely intelligent and eloquent. Harada Roshi, Roshi Kaplow's first main teacher in Japan in the 1950s, the early 1950s, he said that women tend to have a kensho experience sooner than men, a first awakening experience, because men tend to traffic in thoughts more than women. I wouldn't be sure that that's true from the students I've had, but I think there is some truth to the fact that women, I'm really skating on thin ice here. But I'm going to keep going past the point of no return. Women are more of the earth. They're more in their bodies. They're more in their feelings. Men tend to be, and I will stand by this, men tend to be more in their thoughts and in their heads, not as much in their bodies. Maybe that's the one little kernel of truth that resonates with me with what Harada Roshi said. It's just our ability to detach from our thoughts. Yet it's so pleasurable for some people, so they derive so much pleasure from relating concepts to one another. In a talk one evening, Dogen said, at a Zen monastery in China, just so people maybe don't understand this, Dogen was Japanese, but in those days, in the 13th century, there was no Zen to speak of in Japan. He sort of brought it to Japan, so he had to go to China to train. And so he often refers to China because there wasn't much of Zen in Japan for him to refer to. At a Zen monastery in China, the monks were in the habit of sorting the wheat and rice, separating the good from the bad, and making their meals from the good alone. A Zen master warned against this practice, "Even if my head were split into 7 pieces, I would not sort the rice." What he meant, now this is Dogen speaking, what he meant was that monks should not concern themselves with what they have to eat. Just take what is there. If it is good, enjoy it. If it is bad, eat it without distaste. Just practice, eating enough to avoid starving and maintain your life with the food provided by the faithful donors and with the unstained food stored in the monastery. This means that you are not to pass judgment on the food on the basis of how it tastes. Your students training under me now should bear this in mind. So we have, as some of you know, certainly the staff, we have a rule, a long-standing rule, it's always been the case here, that people are not to comment on the food. There's a certain amount of snickering about that and not taking it seriously, but this is where it comes from. Is as long as we're indulging in thoughts about our liking or disliking the food, then this really prevents us from being grateful for being nourished by the food, regardless of how it tastes. So there may be those who snicker about this, but I'm going to hold fast to this. This is our responsibility. The Sangha provides the staff with food, and it should not be an issue of what we like or dislike about it. The kitchen makes amazing food, delicious food, nourishing food. That's enough. Without commenting on any particular day whether you like this or you don't like that. This is a famous passage that I've read before, but not in a while. Dogen said, "When I stayed at the Tiantung Monastery in China, the abbot, Zhu Qing, practiced Zazen until 11 o'clock at night, then got up at 2:30 or 3 and started in again." This is the abbot, no doubt, deeply enlightened. "He sat in the meditation hall with the elder monks without missing a single night. In the meantime, many of the other monks in the assembly would fall asleep. Zhu Qing made the rounds, striking the sleeping monks with his fist or slipper, shaming them and demanding that they wake up. If some of the monks still persisted in sleeping, he would go to the small building to the rear of the meditation hall, strike a bell, and summon an attendant. By candlelight, he would deliver a lecture to the whole assembly. 'What's the use of gathering in the meditation hall and then wasting your time sleeping? Is this what you left your homes for and entered the monastery? Do you see the emperor, government officials, or anybody, for that matter, living a life of ease?'" What's the point of leaving the ordinary world and entering a Zen monastery if you are only going to waste time? Birth and death are vital matters. Intransigency is always upon us. Zen and the teaching schools all agree in this. Death or some dread disease may strike tonight or tomorrow morning. With time so short, how foolish it is to fail to practice the Buddha Dharma and to waste one's time in sleep. This is what makes the law of the Dharma decline. When Buddhism flourished everywhere, monks in all Zen monasteries concentrated solely on Zazen. It came through my mind today that my sister who died this past week sat Sesshin in this room, in this Zendo, and came to sittings in this Zendo. Going to do one last one hymn. This is also a very famous passage, words of Dogen. Although each individual inherently possesses the way, the gaining of it depends on all the monks practicing together. Although an individual may have a brilliant mind, the practice of the way depends upon the strength of many. Therefore, unifying your minds and concentrating your determination, practice under a teacher and seek the way. Jewels become objects of beauty by polishing. A person becomes a true person by training. What jewel is lustrous from the beginning? What person is superior from the outset? You must always keep polishing and always keep training. Do not deprecate yourselves and relax in your practice of the way. An old master has said, do not spend your time wastefully. And then Dogen says, I ask you, is time something that will stop if you value it, or is it something that cannot be stopped, no matter how you value it? This you must understand. It is not time that passes in vain, but people that pass their time in vain. Neither time nor people should be wasted. Devote yourselves to the practice of the way. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.